Hi, my name is Mariam, and today I'll be hosting the very first episode of the Epicon podcast. Palestinian and Israeli civil society still has agency. Agency over shaping the current realities and the future of Palestine and Israel. Against all odds, courageous individuals from both sides are choosing to engage, to defy political stagnation, and to present concrete ideas and plans for a peaceful solution. These individuals insist that peace is not simply a diplomatic agreement. It must be built on the ground through dialogue, human connection, and shared commitment. They claim that it is the responsibility of political leaders to listen and to translate their insights and proposals into decision-making and real action. Our Palestinian and Israeli guests on this podcast include former prisoners and soldiers, relatives of hostages, leading peace activists and mediators, scholars, legal experts, and more. Voices rarely heard in Europe. They bring forward-thinking, pragmatic, and actionable ideas in response to a central question. What can Europe do? Today, we are joined by Dr. Jamal Nusseibeh, a Palestinian-American lawyer, legal scholar, and investor. He taught law at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem and has been deeply involved in Palestinian affairs since the 90s, including in peace negotiations. Dr. Nusseibeh has spoken on Middle Eastern affairs in numerous fora, including on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and at the UK House of Lords. He's also a frequent commentator and analyst in various English and Arabic-speaking media outlets. As a member of the Palestinian Technical Working Group, he co-authored a new working paper titled A Palestinian Armistice Plan, Charting a Rights-Based Transition for Palestinian-Israeli Peace, that was published just recently in June 25. This paper presents a comprehensive political roadmap for a permanent ceasefire in the occupied Palestinian territory and Israel, as well as for a structured transition period toward a just and durable peace agreement. In this episode, Dr. Jamal Nusseibeh will talk us through the main elements of this proposal. We will discuss why it's necessary to structure such plans around Palestinian self-determination and as a rights-based process, and how realistic such a framework is. We'll also get into the importance of international engagement and specifically address Europe's role. It's a pleasure to have you here, Jamal.
Thank you, Mariam. Nice to be here.
Jamal, if you don't mind, let's start with you sharing some personal and professional insights about your involvement with the Palestine question.
Sure. So I was born Palestinian. I mean, being Palestinian is something that one is. One doesn't really choose it. And I grew up in Jerusalem in the 80s at a time when in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, and the, where I was living was very much under occupation. It still is. In those days, it was more recognized as such by the world. And one of the things that's actually changed a lot is how the world now perceives Jerusalem as perhaps more Israeli, although on the ground it's not. East Jerusalem remains very much a separate entity for those who live there, for the Palestinians who live there. And as a Palestinian growing up under occupation in Jerusalem, I was very aware of the presence of the occupation, the Israeli military and so on, the fact that our lives were extremely restricted in many ways. And as I grew up, the First Intifada began in late 1987, and it took hold of all of our lives. So I guess you could say that the cause of freedom and rights was something that I was born with and was part of my DNA. And throughout the rest of my life, I went abroad to study, I went back, I went abroad again, I went back. And I've always felt a need, myself personally, to contribute somehow to achieving freedom for the Palestinians, for my people. The last decade or so, I was not involved, or not very involved. I had switched to the private sector. I was working in investments and energy and all of these things, far away from that. And then really with October 7 and the Israeli actions since then, I realized that there was an urgent... I couldn't sit down. I mean, there was no way that I could just sit by and watch the annihilation of my people, and therefore began to think about what I could do to help, how one could stop it, and how we could also ensure that it wouldn't happen again. And it wouldn't happen again for the Palestinians, for the Israelis, how we could finally end this conflict and find a way to live together, side by side or together. It actually doesn't really matter how. The point is just to find a way to no longer be in conflict, so that the next generation doesn't grow up this way, so that the next generation grows up with safety and hope, and not just a future, but actually a safe present. I also have a branch of my family that is in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, some of them have been killed in the past year or two. And obviously not just that, but colleagues and friends, or family of colleagues and friends. So this is a personal issue as mm-hmm. well as being a kind of national one, if you like.
Thank you for sharing. Now, before we get into the key components of the armistice plan, I want to point out that we are recording on the 9th of July, just 2 days after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was welcomed by US President Donald Trump at the White House. When asked by reporters whether a two-state solution that creates an independent Palestine was possible, Trump said, "I don't know," and referred the question to Netanyahu, who replied, and I quote directly, "I think the Palestinians should have all the powers to govern themselves, but none of the powers to threaten us. That means a sovereign power like overall security will always remain in our hands. Now that is a fact, and no one in Israel will agree to anything else because we don't commit suicide." Later he added that another Palestinian state would be a platform to destroy Israel, as can be seen with what he called the current Hamas state. What, in your opinion, are the implications of this, of such statements, of such framing for the future of Palestine?
So, I mean, I would say that I would turn that round against Prime Minister Netanyahu and say, I think the Israelis should also have the power to govern their lives, but not the power to threaten us. Mm-hmm. The power to threaten is not actually a civilized thing to have, or a civilized way of doing business. What we need, and what the world needs, and what people tried to do after the Second World War, was institute a rules-based order to prevent countries from using power and threat as a means of achieving what they perceive to be their interests. And I think that the attitude that's being portrayed there, apart from being paternalistic, colonialist, and so on, is also indicative of a problematic attitude towards the future of our region. At another level, I would also say that it doesn't really matter what Prime Minister Netanyahu thinks, that people have a right to be free, that people have a right to self-determination as a people, and that they have a right to express themselves in the form of a polity, of a state, because that's what our system is based on, whether or not their occupier, in this case Israel, thinks that's a good idea. it's not really Israel's choice. But if I were to respond also in a, on another point, I would say that I don't see a state of Palestine, if it is done correctly, a real state of Palestine, with proper borders along the 1948 armistice line, which are the 1967 borders, up to 1967. I don't see that as a source of threat to Israel in any case. I see that as a source of the end of the threat to Israel. What Prime Minister Netanyahu has, I think, failed to understand throughout his many, many decades in politics is that Israeli security is not going to be guaranteed unless there is peace. So what he needs to understand, and what some Israelis already understand, but I think we need to get this message through to more of them, is that the paradigm needs to change. It is peace first, and it is the peace that will get you the security that is so much needed and wanted. And security, by the way, is something I don't like the concept of security. Mm-hmm. I prefer, if we're going to use that term, I would talk about human security. It's a much broader term, it's a much more individual term, it involves things like the ability to have food and shelter and so on. And I like the term safety. I want people to feel safe. And if we look at the security situation now in Palestine, Israel, there's and the people who are the most insecure and who are suffering the most from that lack of security are the Palestinians, not the Israelis. And they continue to do so every day. I mean, we have at the moment, we as Palestinians, mainly in Gaza, but also in the West Bank and Jerusalem, are being killed at a rate of almost 100 per day. That's a lot of insecurity, believe me.
Yeah.
So I would say that we need to shift the paradigm, and we need to flip it so that peace comes first.
Mm-hmm.
And I would point to the fact, or two facts. I would point first to the fact that the security paradigm, walls, fences, technology, tanks, helicopters, whatever, failed both to detect and to prevent the horrors that were inflicted upon Israel on October 7th by Hamas. They just failed. And on the other hand, I would also say that the states with which Israel has peace agreements, Jordan, Egypt, have been a source of comfort and protection to the Israelis, even during the last 2 years of extreme violence and potentially extreme unrest in both of those countries. But both the Jordanians and the Egyptians, and indeed other countries in the region, have helped to provide Israel with a security blanket and to keep it safe, despite many popular movements mm-hmm. in the opposite direction. So it is their peace agreements, the peace agreements they have with Israel, that have kept Israel safe.
Yeah. What I do wonder is when you say that it doesn't really matter what Netanyahu says, like, for me, it's just the fact that he's sitting there with President Donald Trump, who is a big actor in all of this, and he's also like not saying anything against it. So he would be one to maybe have the power to influence the change that you say is required. So this is where I don't understand, like, I understand like that you say it doesn't really matter what he says, but in the end it does somehow matter if no one is speaking against him, right?
Sure. And look, from a power perspective, you're right. I mean, Israel is a very powerful country, a very powerful army. It has controlled, dominated, occupied, and is colonizing our land since decades. And we've been trying to get them to stop occupying us through peaceful means for decades as well, and it hasn't worked. There is a clear, massive imbalance of power. Israel is very strongly supported by its allies abroad, first and foremost the United States, but also European countries and others. Mm. And I think, of course, yes, it matters. And I am aware, very aware, that our future as Palestinians depends on us being able to work together with the Israelis to convince the Israelis that we are, to use a much abused term, I think, but it is true, partners mm-hmm. in peace. That doesn't mean that I want to necessarily, as I say, live with them, mm-hmm. but that we have to take responsibility for building a better future together, individually, separately, but also to work together towards that outcome. And when it comes to the US, I think that President Trump has actually shown a lot of ability, a lot of interest in resolving the situation, and that's something that we haven't seen from a US administration in a while. Mm-hmm. I think he's shown that he has a lot of leverage, and we've seen that both with the first ceasefire, which then Israel breached, but also with the situation in Iran, where he was able to call back the Israeli jets that were off to bomb once again, and he just picked up the phone and called apparently Prime Minister Netanyahu and got the jets to turn around. Mm-hmm. So he has the leverage and he's willing to use it, and he wants to have an outcome that he thinks will hopefully be fitting and sufficient to give him a Nobel Prize, mm-hmm. which is great. I mean, I would love him to get a Nobel Prize for a peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis for a peaceful Middle East. But the difficulty that we have here is that we need to make sure that what he's doing there is not being diverted. He's not being led up the garden path by Netanyahu. Because one thing that we do know is that Netanyahu has, since his early days in politics, done his utmost to undermine the possibility of peace with the Palestinians, to undermine the possibility of a two-state solution. And he's boasted about it. I mean, he's very proud of it. He's proud of his achievements in this matter. And so my hope is that the US administration and President Trump are interested in a peaceful outcome, that they know that they have the leverage that they want to use and that they can use, that they also are interested in a regional peaceful outcome as well. They have other regional allies, not only Israel, and those allies also want peace and want an end to this conflict on the basis of a Palestinian state along 1967 borders. Saudi Arabia, all of the Arab League has announced that they will happily work with and accept Israel as a full member of the region with open economic relations and political relations, as long as it fulfills this relatively simple condition. So I think that the US administration could achieve this. What you don't want, or what one doesn't want, is for them to be, as I say, misled by the current Israeli government into putting a band-aid on the situation and then hoping for the best, because that doesn't work. It hasn't worked in the past. It won't work now. And I really honestly believe, apart from the fact that the killing in Gaza needs to stop, we need to surge humanitarian aid, this is not a subject for agreement. This is just something that needs to happen. And if I were President Trump, I would just do that now, yeah. because that would be his win. I mean, imagine, he tells Netanyahu, look, just stop bombing. Stop the bombing. Take your soldiers out of Gaza. They don't need to be in Gaza. Why are they there now? Nobody's attacking Israel from Gaza. The only killing that's happening in Gaza is happening inside Gaza. They're just shooting people in the streets, in cafes, in hospitals.
But why do you think he's not saying this?
Well, maybe he hasn't yet thought about how this would work. So I would suggest that he could read our plan and it might give him some ideas. But for me, the win would be there. Mm-hmm. The win would be to actually not do the same thing that's been tried over the decades in the past many times and has always failed. The win would be not to do what Prime Minister Netanyahu and his extremist government want the US to do, because they aren't interested in peace. Everybody knows this. What he could do is do his best thinking outside the box, which we know he does, and do things differently. And if he were to tell the Israelis, just stop, pull out of Gaza, stop the killing in Gaza and the West Bank, you pause the hostilities, no need for an agreement. And then we can sit down without that and just work out what, by the way, in our plan we're calling for is an armistice agreement. So a long-term cessation of violence and hostilities between the Israelis and Palestinians. And I say this, by the way, that's very important, not between Israel and Hamas, because Hamas is one faction, it's one political party. The conflict is not between Israel and Hamas. The conflict is between Israel and the Palestinians. And for a solution to be durable, even for a ceasefire and cessation of hostilities to be durable, it has to be all-encompassing, it has to be holistic, it has to be all of Palestine and Israel, all of the Palestinians, and all of the Israelis.
For now, let's take a moment to go over the key components of the armistice plan. So unlike what we discussed earlier, what Netanyahu has said, and other proposals that have been made, your plan outlines a transition that is rooted not in containment, but in self-determination, accountability, and international law. So I'd like to ask you to explain and briefly elaborate on the core elements of your proposal.
So there's a few basic elements, and then there's obviously a lot of detail.
Yeah.
And then there's an overall point. So let me start with the overall point. What this aims to do, what this plan aims to do, is not be a peace agreement between Israel and Palestine or Israel and the Palestinians. I don't believe that this is a situation where we are ready or able to sign or enter into a peace agreement. We don't. The level of trauma on the Palestinian side, also on the Israeli side, and the level of destruction on the Palestinian side, the level of healing and rebuilding that's going to be needed, just again starting with basic food and shelter, is enormous. I mean, the mind boggles at the level, the scale of the destruction right now in Gaza. I'm extremely worried because, as you know, that's also been happening in the West Bank. It's also, if things now stop in Gaza, the last time they paused in Gaza, Israel upped its operations in the West Bank and also then began to carry out military operations in the refugee camps, in Tul Kerem, in Nur Shams, and Jenin. So I'm nervous that this will get even worse in the West Bank. It's on the verge of it. It's already pretty bad. So this is not a situation where either side is able to enter into the contours or the final peace agreement yet. What we need is two things, I think. First, basic human security, the food, the shelter, the aid, but also the protection from being killed, the ability to know that we're going to be alive tomorrow, unless obviously one can never know that, but at least within reason. And that's an essential part of this plan, sort of guaranteeing that. For both, for the Israelis also, and the Palestinians. But also then a time period, a transitional time period, during which this continues, this safety and security is provided, and we're calling for international peacekeepers to do that in the West Bank and Gaza and Palestine and Israel, along the lines as well. And this is what will allow the Palestinians and the Israelis both first to begin to heal, to calm down, to have some breathing space, and to begin to build also within their societies, and to be able to think more clearly and rationally and hopefully about a future and how they want that future to look. So it's only at the end of this transition that one would enter into a peace agreement between Palestinians and Israelis. And at that point, it may well be that after the transition period, when everything is calm, that any one of a number of other solutions, creative solutions, might be the one that is chosen. So it could be a two-state solution. It could be a confederation along the lines of, for instance, a land for all. Mm-hmm. It could be a one state if that's what people want. It's possible. But right now we're not there. So the overarching things are we need to provide safety and security for Palestinians and Israelis. We're incapable of doing that for ourselves. So that needs to be provided from the outside by peacekeepers. Mm-hmm. And second, that the transitional period is necessary in order for us to be able to reach a peace agreement. And that transitional period will allow us to be able to work on our internal society structures, politics, reform, etc. I hope on the Israeli side as well, but certainly on the Palestinian side. And then the third thing is, and this is sort of now coming a bit lower, is, well, what is it that makes this different from, let's say, the infamous roadmaps of the past? Hmm. And you mentioned the term roadmap, yeah, in your introduction, and I thought, I don't like roadmap. Palestinians, okay, don't like roadmaps. Mm. And in fact, at some point over the past couple of years, people were talking about, well, we need a pathway to a state instead of roadmap. They're now using pathway. Mm. We're beyond that. Mm-hmm. The Oslo process that was begun in 1993 was a roadmap or a pathway or something that was supposed to lead in the end to a Palestinian state. It failed. Mm. And it was supposed to, by the way, lead to a Palestinian state in 1998. So one of the basic premises of this is that of this plan is that the Oslo process is over. The Oslo agreements are defunct, they're null and void. And what applies, therefore, is the basic international legal structure, which means that, as reconfirmed by the ICJ in its advisory opinion, the whole of 1967 occupied Palestinian territory, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, are occupied territory. And as you know, there are many obligations that came out of this opinion, including the obligation of states, such as European states and others, to ensure that the impact and effects of this occupation were countered, that they were not supporting this occupation in any way. We're yet to see how that's going to translate into action by Europe or others. We're definitely seeing action on this front, by the way, by other countries, members of BRICS or the Global South. You mentioned that Netanyahu is in Washington, or was in Washington yesterday. But also, I don't know if you saw, the president of Colombia wrote an article yesterday talking about a conference that they are organizing on the 15th of July, mm-hmm, in Bogota, mm-hmm, which is specifically aiming to address this gap in the enforcement of international law and the need to reinforce the rules-based system, the international rules-based system, in light of how Israel is behaving. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I would say there are more countries that actually see the need for this and for this law-based structure than you might think. And by the way, I'm just going to mention that if I were Ukrainian, I would be leading this charge. Mm-hmm. I would be leading this effort to stand up for international law and the rules-based order, because that end of Europe, which is being protected by Ukraine, as I understand, from Russia, that is completely reliant on international law and the illegality of occupation. So I, you know, so our, the third part, I'll wrap it up now, is just that we are relying on this international law. The basis is the occupied territory, the occupied Palestinian territory of 19, which was occupied in 1967. And we're also saying that a Palestinian state already exists in that territory.
Let's talk about reform and political representation. Your plan highlights the need for reform across various sectors in Palestine, including PLO reform, also technocratic governance, and, as you mentioned earlier, even engagement with Hamas. Could you elaborate on that? How do you see it working, and what should reform actually look like?
So I'll pick up the last point I just made, which was that we say a Palestinian state already exists. The Palestinian state exists because it was declared already by the Palestinians in 1988. It's been recognized by 149 countries or something around the world. And it is necessary that we start with this because the Palestinian state gives us the context in which to both look outwards and look inwards. Looking outwards, it allows us to interact with the rest of the world, including Israel. It gives us a line, a borderline, which is the 1967 line, along which peacekeepers can maintain the peace. They will also obviously have to be inside the West Bank. There are settlements there. We're being realistic here. And we have to work out how exactly the peacekeepers would function within the West Bank and around settlement blocks. But it is clear that the Palestinian state needs to be there because this is the entity that will be able to request, as it has done, by the way, the presence of international peacekeepers. And it also provides us, so that's sort of outwards looking, but inwards looking, it provides us with two things. First, it provides the Palestinians with a reassurance, another form of security. And I mention this here because in many of my conversations back home, people are now, their biggest fear is that we're going to be exterminated, wiped out. And, you know, that fear is both physical. I mean, people in Gaza are worried that they will be dead by the afternoon, or killed. But it's also a more general fear that the current Israeli government is intent on wiping us out. We have had many statements.
Yeah.
We have had many televised addresses. We've had letters. We've had clear statements of intent. Yeah. Which is partly why, obviously, the ICC said that there was a plausible case of genocide. And it's in this intent, this plausible intent, that I understand, although this is not my specialty, but that I understand that they have found that, they made that finding on that basis, that it's intent to do this. The other side of that intent and of the actions that we're seeing in Gaza and the West Bank and Jerusalem is the fear, terror. I mean, we're terrified. So the state, the Palestinian state, saying that it exists now, tells us that at least we will not be wiped off the map. We know that this is the last chance. I think the Israeli government is also well aware of this. This is the last chance, the last moment when a two-state solution, which actually has a state of Palestine, is possible. And the fear is that there will be either no Palestinians left or no Palestine left very soon. So we need the reassurance that all of these international legal instruments, going back to the early UN Security Council resolutions on the illegality of the acquisition of territory by force, 242, 338, and all of the ICJ decisions and opinions, that these will be implemented, mm-hmm. and that there is a legal basis, a legal guarantee, a legal ground which will not be given up. Mm-hmm. So it is important. It's also important because, given what we saw with Oslo and the other roadmaps, it's important that the Palestinians know that the state is there, because then we can work from that basis towards something maybe else, something better. We can either build that state, and we need the state, because otherwise how are you going to build an economy? Mm-hmm. What context are you going to build an economy in? Mm-hmm. How can you interact with your neighbors, your neighboring countries, including Israel, mm-hmm. if you're not actually a state? And equally, how can you rebuild inside? Mm-hmm. And that's the was a long preamble to the response to your question.
Yeah, but this is the base to make reformation possible.
It is the foundation. It's the platform. Yeah. Because at the moment, we are in a situation where the Palestinian Authority, which was created under the Oslo and as a result of the Oslo agreements, mm-hmm. Is operating with extremely limited jurisdiction, even in the West Bank, much more limited even than it was supposed to have under the Oslo agreements, and certainly much less than a Palestinian government ought to have. And we have a PLO which is essentially marginalized, sidelined, and unreformed. Now, we need to bring back the PLO in order to make sure that the Palestinians are all represented: Gaza, the West Bank, Jerusalem, the diaspora, the refugees. And we need to make sure that, therefore, the PLO implements the agreement that it entered into with Hamas and the other Palestinian factions about a year ago in Beijing. And this was a time when Hamas essentially signed up to the PLO political program, which means it basically also agrees to a two-state solution and also agrees to hand over power to power in Gaza, for instance, mm-hmm. legitimate authority, to a legitimate Palestinian government. So that agreement is somehow hanging. It hasn't been implemented. One of the things that we talk about in the plan in a very early stage, following the immediate cessation of hostilities and the surge of aid, is to bring in Hamas and the other factions under the umbrella of the PLO to implement the Beijing agreement, mm-hmm. and we propose a more practical mechanism. We call it a factions agreement, to give teeth, if you like, to the Beijing declaration, to make sure that it functions. And we see this as the beginning of the process of reform. So mm-hmm. you start by including Hamas and the factions under the PLO. The PLO can then enter into an agreement on behalf of everybody with the Israelis, and that agreement would be an armistice agreement. And it would be an armistice agreement that basically says, look, there's Palestine, there's Israel, the Palestinians and the Israelis are agreeing to an armistice. We're not going to kill each other, we're not going to fight with each other, and that's going to be guaranteed by the peacekeepers for the next 2 or 3 years.
The peacekeepers are?
International. Okay. They can be Arab-led, they can be US-led, they can be European-led. They can be. They should ideally have a UN mandate, mm-hmm. but whether they are actually UN blue helmets or some other multilateral force, I think the key element there is that they are UN mandated.
Okay.
We don't want, and that's actually become even more obvious in the last few months, because what you really don't want is some opaque, internationally dubious group of contractors to come in under a name like the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, yeah. and start taking things over. Mm-hmm. We need people to come in who are proper peacekeepers, who abide by the rule of law, who understand why they're there, who understand what values they are representing and what values they are also transmitting to the people they work with on the ground. So for me, the United Nations is by far the best qualified on that side. Mm-hmm. I think that the US also has a lot of experience with having boots on the ground and could work pretty well in a context where it also had regional partners and allies who have said they would be happy to support. I don't know, the Emirates, mm-hmm. Qatar, mm-hmm. Jordan, Egypt have already been helping. So there's a lot of ways this could pan out. But they need to come in and they need to have a proper UN mandate. They need to be transparent and clear, and they need to be doing a good job mm-hmm. of monitoring and ideally actually enforcing, making sure that there are no breaches of the armistice. Mm-hmm. And you took me away from the sort of internal stuff as well, but it is important that you have the political context, so the state and the inclusion of everybody in the PLO, in order also to legitimize the peacekeepers and what comes next. Mm-hmm. Because what you don't want is for the peacekeepers to be viewed as an extension of Israeli occupation. The peacekeepers have to come in at the request of the Palestinians to protect the Palestinians and the Israelis, of course, mm-hmm. but they have to be there as something different. They have to be there as actually an expression of Palestinian sovereignty and not as a denial of it.
So while all of this stands in major contrast to other plans that seek to avoid Palestinian leadership entirely, which is, of course, an important point, I'd like to get back to a question that we only touched on briefly. So what would be the ultimate outcome of this armistice? You mentioned the possibility of a two-state solution or perhaps a land for all, and there are various ideas out there. But in your plan, do you outline a specific, concrete outcome that you see as most likely, or do you, for example, address the two-state solution directly?
In the plan, we're very deliberately and we are very clear about being mm-hmm. agnostic about what the final peace agreement looks like. There is no reason to preempt it at the minute, mm-hmm. and I can maybe imagine, but I don't know if I can imagine enough what it would be like to be in a situation of actual calm mm-hmm. and safety for 3 or 4 years, or however many, like let's say 3 years,
yeah.
and have freedom of political expression and all of this happening at the same time. I don't know what people will end up choosing or where they'll decide to go, and I don't want to preempt it.
Okay.
But I would also say something else, which is, and I think I said it with you before, maybe mm-hmm. in the room, not here, but you know, peace isn't actually the end. Mm-hmm. Peace is just the beginning. It's mm-hmm. a required necessity. It's a need to be able to do things, to be able to build, to be able to have a life, to be able to think freely and live happily. Mm-hmm. Peace is not some faraway goal. Peace is something you have to have in order to do everything.
Yeah.
And so peace is not the solution. Peace is a need so that we can build mm-hmm. a future. And there is no point, I think, at which we will know that we have a solution. We will just be at peace and we will be living normal lives. And then at some point we'll realize that actually things are okay. And this is, I think, important because the same applies to the two-state solution. Mm-hmm. I think that it's important to start with the two states mm-hmm. because at the moment that is the most efficient way of giving both peoples a sense of security and safety and a political framework that allows them to express themselves. And by the way, the Israelis express themselves in Israel and so on. And I'm not going to go into the difficult debates around Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship, the Israeli Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are struggling with that self-expression within Israel. But leaving that aside for now, the Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, need to have a polity in which to express themselves. And so do, by the way, the Palestinians who are abroad. Mm-hmm. The ones who are outside Palestine and Israel, the ones who are still in refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and who are just scattered around the world. And the two polities for those expressions are the state, for those who are inside the West Bank, East Jerusalem and Gaza, and the PLO as an expression of the entire people. Mm-hmm. And that has to run parallel until such time as the final peace agreement is signed. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, what you're doing by having a state first, not at the end, is you're saying that part of the solution is here. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is then how it works, how that state is going to come into existence, how it's going to operate, how it's going to interact with Israel and its neighbors. And that really is what the solution is. It's the development into the future, the building of bridges and ties, the building of infrastructure and the building of the bases on which you have that future.
So as you say that peace is a necessity to build a future, how, if peace is achieved, how will it be kept? Can we make sure that peace will last?
I think nobody can ever be sure of mm-hmm. anything. But mm-hmm. I would say that, and this depends on how you understand the reason for the conflict. So I do not see this as, this is not a religious conflict. Palestinians have no problem with Jews. I have no problem with Jews. Palestinians are a multicultural, multi-religious civilization that in the past, until the creation of the State of Israel, was not only Muslim and Christian, but also Jewish. So this is not a religious conflict. And the fact that it is becoming increasingly religious is an issue. We need to address that, mm-hmm. Just as we need to address all the extremism that we see also now on the Israeli side with this mm-hmm. sort of the messianic hilltop youth and so on. We need to address that. And the only way that I can see to address that is through providing people with hope, and a real hope. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just some vague thing, but actually a life in which they can live free with dignity and express themselves and work towards something that will be better for them in the future. So for me, this context, this structure, mm-hmm. is how you deal with the possibility of future conflict. Mm-hmm. It's how you deal. Now, you won't deal with everyone. There will be people who are angry. There will be people who want to spoil. There will be people who, and I think this is bound to be the case. Mm-hmm. But I also think that in the case of this plan, for instance, mm-hmm. if you actually have a Palestinian state recognized on those borders, with the peace being kept by international peacekeepers, and the ability to begin to express yourself as a Palestinian through these mechanisms that we have that we're putting in place for the transitional period, like citizens' assemblies and other forms of citizen participation and oversight, then you have a strong interest in building what you have. Nobody wants to keep fighting. Mm-hmm. The Gazans don't want to be bombed every day. Mm-hmm. Nor do the people in the West Bank want to have their houses burned down by settlers every day. People want to be able to have normal lives. And therefore, in my view, you would actually find a surge of support mm-hmm. for this structure as it stands, and also for continuing and maintaining a peaceful situation. So you're addressing the root causes of the violence, mm-hmm. As opposed to trying to fight people into a corner. And I would say, if you flip it, if you don't do something like this, if you don't tell the Palestinians, okay, you know what, international law is clear, you have waited too long, you've made so many concessions, you've suffered so much, it's enough. Mm-hmm. You have your state, and we're going to protect it. 67 borders, that's what everybody agreed, and that's what the law says is fair. So there you go. If you don't do this, then what you're doing is telling the Palestinians that it's basically, there's only one way that they will ever be free. And if it's not going to be through law negotiations, then you're going to push everybody into militarization. And not just in Palestine, but also further afield. Mm-hmm. And that will lead to regional destabilization, and it will lead to the region plunging into a mess, a quagmire, which it will take us decades to get out of. So the two sides of that are, one, I think that you need to provide this context, and you need to give people a sense that they're being treated fairly and that they don't have to worry about being wiped off the map mm-hmm. anymore. It's fine. And that gives the support to the peace and the end of hostilities, and takes away, hopefully, and over time will take away more of the reasons for conflict and violence with Israel. But also the alternative to that is, if you don't do it, and if you don't do it very soon, because this is pretty much the last chance, as most people are saying and know, then you're going to say to the Palestinians and to everybody else, forget international law, forget diplomacy and negotiations, it's all a joke. You're going to either live subjugated under somebody's boot, watching your land, your homes, your culture, your civilization be wiped off the map, or you're going to get up and do what everybody, I think, would be brought up to do in that case, which is resist.
I understand that you're implying that peace is not a matter of destiny, but a question of political will. So what, in your opinion, is the main contributor to peace?
Agency. It's agency. And, you know, I can tell you that as Palestinians, we are victims and we have been suffering and, but I don't want to be a victim. I want to be a protagonist. I want to, being free means taking responsibility for things and acting. That's what being free is. Being free isn't sitting down and waiting for someone to do something, tell you what to do. You know, I can be free in that way in a prison cell. I can be responsible for what my actions are within a jail. The fact is, I'm still in a jail.
Yeah.
And occupation is a jail. Mm-hmm. It's a jail which controls all of the outer bounds of the lives of a Palestinian, plus a lot of what they do inside. In Gaza, they were even controlling how many calories went in every day. I mean, for 20 years almost. Mm-hmm. So, yes. And I think that, by the way, even despite the deficiencies of the Oslo structures and the agreements and the difficulties that we faced with the occupation during that time, there was still an extraordinary amount of Palestinian building and Palestinian development, building meaning building institutions and things, Palestinian development and Palestinian agency. Mm-hmm. Now, the context that was being done in was extremely minimal. It was a slightly larger jail. We had a few more privileges. But it gives me hope that the Palestinians can build something great. Mm-hmm. It gives me hope that the Palestinians are more than capable of constructing a state that is functioning. And I, for one, really want whatever we build to be something that we can be proud of, mm-hmm. but also that the world can look at and say, wow, that's how things should be. Mm-hmm. You know, this is our opportunity. If it's a new state coming out of nothing and we have a chance to do it, we should do it right. We should make it as efficient, as effective, as transparent and democratic, as prosperous and successful as it can be. It should be an example to states. That's what I want my Palestine to be. My Palestine has to be that. And therefore I am frustrated with the current leadership, obviously. I am frustrated with the current situation that we've been pushed into by the Oslo Accords and the situation with Israel in the intervening years. And I think it's extremely important that as we move forward, if we have this context, and I do hope that we'll be able to move forward in this direction, and I understand that this current Israeli government at least will find it difficult, but I have hope that many other Israelis will see why it is necessary and good. But if we do move forward, then we need to make sure that we build in, and that's also in the plan, a way of avoiding the pitfalls of Oslo. All of the ones that we've seen, including potential corruption, including ensuring more citizen involvement in governance, including and leading up to proper elections, real elections, both for the Palestinians in Palestine, for the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, for the Palestinian state, but also for the PLO as a representative of all the Palestinians, because these are two entities which are very far from being democratically representative. And I believe that the Palestinians, their suffering maybe makes them victims, but I also think that it means that we deserve better. I think that the Palestinians deserve better than to be given a new governor at some point, and who's going to be placed in there by somebody else, and who's going to just keep things the way they are. We deserve more. And I'm not sitting here I'm not a supplicant, I'm not asking for more. I'm saying we will build better and we will get more, and in the end what we are asking for, and through this plan we're helping to show how you can get rid of the prison that surrounds us and allow us to begin to build a free house, let's say. But in the absence of this plan, as I say, then there is no choice but to keep banging on the prison door.
We've seen that states like Spain, Ireland, Norway, they recognized Palestine in recent months, which I wonder, do you see it as something symbolical? Is it like, does it show political will, or like in the end, what is the role of Europe in all of this? What can and what should they do to support Palestinian self-determination?
I mean, so answer the first part, yes, it's extremely important. And it is enormously appreciated, because if nothing else, it tells the Palestinians that they're not alone and they're not forgotten. And I think that for those who are stuck in Gaza, to hear that a country like Spain or Norway has stepped up and seen them means an enormous amount. It doesn't, obviously, they need food and they need shelter and they need medicines. I'm not going to kind of go over this. And I know, but I have to repeat it because it is just, but it is important, Miriam. It is extremely important. And, but it's not the only thing, because taking the recognition step is ideally should be done in the form, again, that we put forward in the plan. Meaning you should then take the necessary legal consequences of that to the next step. So what does that mean? There's a Palestinian state. The Palestinian state is under occupation. It's under attack. How do we, as, let's say now I'm speaking as a European nation, well, the ICJ said this is under occupation. We say this is a Palestinian state under occupation. The Palestinian state is requesting peacekeepers. It's requesting help. So there are different ways that we need to approach this, but definitely the legal pathway is clear. Politically, it's a little bit more fraught. But at least, and Spain has begun to do this, stop supporting the Israeli government in its actions. At least stop providing arms. At least put sanctions on those members of the Israeli government that are, let's say, beyond the pale, at the very least. mm-hmm. at least apply international law and enforce the warrants of the International Criminal Court,
mm-hmm.
which really, it should not be a request.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a request from the Palestinians. This is a legal requirement by an international body which was created by treaty in 1998 by all of these countries
mm-hmm.
to great fanfare. Everybody was extremely proud and extremely happy that this International Criminal Court had been created, and now suddenly, and make sure at the very least that Europe stands up for the international legal order, because I think that this is a moment that Europe is about to miss.
Mm-hmm.
The world, from my humble perspective, it looks to me like the world is teetering.
Mm-hmm.
It's not sure which way it's going. It looks like the international legal order, to the extent there was one, is collapsing. Maybe it's already collapsed. And you have a resurgence of power politics, of realpolitik, bombing, and so on and so forth. How, and at the same time, you have a whole enormous part of the world which we're not talking about yet here, the global south, some of whose countries are actually very powerful economically, who care about the rules-based order.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of their DNA. They really want it to be the case. They don't want to let it go. And you've got, in the middle of all of this, you've got Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Europe, which is an international entity. It's not even a nation. Europe is founded by international law. It's based on international law. It has to uphold international law. Because if treaties mean nothing, then why wouldn't, I know, Italy walk away from Europe tomorrow? What are the consequences? So you have to, and you can, as a European, as Europeans, actually hold on to, reinforce that system and potentially become and play a leading role in this world order, which is based on rules and structures and systems that seemed to make sense and seem to make sense to the majority of people in the world. So I would say the role of Europe in this, recognizing the occupation, is a very good start. Recognizing that there is a state of Palestine is another important thing. Recognizing that there are consequences that flow from this and how to end those consequences is another thing. Acting on the basis of the Israeli actions in Gaza and the West Bank, whether you consider them genocidal or not, certainly they are heading and seem to represent many different types of war crime. Do that. Prevent them. Don't support them. Don't send weapons. Let's see some consequences. And don't assume that by not doing anything, you're staying out of it.
Hmm.
Because you're not. Europe is deeply involved, both in the creation of Israel and the reason and causes and justification for its creation, but also for the justification of its morally abhorrent behavior. So I'll say, look, with regards to Europe,
mm-hmm.
I'll give you an answer a little bit like the one I gave about Netanyahu and the state.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are things that seem to be the things that are talked about that may be easier or harder, like the association agreement or sanctioning violent settlers or.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, if you want the truth, what I think Europe should do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is probably politically unrealistic,
mm-hmm.
but it is being seen in countries like Spain and Norway. You have to stand up for what is right and stand against what is wrong. And in this particular case, the right and the wrong are extremely clear, meaning that there is no way that what Israel is doing in Gaza right now, or in the West Bank for that matter, is right. So you have to stop it. You have to call it out at every single point. You have to do everything you can to prevent it from happening. You have to do everything you can to make sure that you are not allowing it or supporting it in happening. And it may well be that a discussion about whether or not to discuss the suspension of the association agreement with Israel is a step in that direction. I don't think it's sufficient. Nor do I believe that acting in these very small steps is in the advantage or interest of either Europe or Israel. Because the longer this goes on, the worse it is going to be for Israel. The more destabilized the region will be, the more misery and hunger and the more that's going to have to be done to rebuild and reconstruct and fix. And unless we fix it now, meaning unless Europe really takes active steps now towards, again, if you come back to my plan, what we're suggesting is the way out, then this is the last moment that this will be able to happen. And then after that, you're going to have another series of conflicts, wars, destabilization, refugees coming into Europe, trade routes blocked in the Strait of Hormuz and the Red Sea, and. So I would say what we need to see is real leadership. We need to see people taking stands. And this is a very easy place, a very easy issue on which to take a stand, because I believe it is one of the few issues where doing the right thing morally is also doing the right thing from an interests perspective for Europe in the region, for itself internally, for itself with regards to, you know, Russia, Ukraine, but also with regards to its role today and in the future in the world and in supporting this rules-based order. So let's see what you do, but get up and do something, Europeans. Come on.
Thank you, Jamal. This was the very first episode of the Epicon podcast. Thank you very much for listening. EPICON stands for European-Palestinian-Israeli Trilateral Dialogue, an initiative that creates and fosters spaces for dialogue between Palestinian and Israeli peace advocates and European opinion leaders. EPICON is implemented by the Kenneth Foundation with the financial support of the European Union. For more information, visit the Candid website and follow us on our EPICON social media accounts linked in the description.